For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
We're going to talk now about something that sometimes people will look at we're just going to get into the fourth piece of this. And I think in this fourth piece, you're going to see that there is a claim that people will often point to argue against the existence of God. So I want to cover it with you today. Now, remember, I'm just going to review again. I'm sure everyone, I know that we're kind of now reformulating into different rooms, but as you know, we're using this template that is looking at using a crime scene. Those are the evidences in the scene. Here's how we explain them. And now, of course, we're going to move into the evidences in the universe and how do we explain them. And now what we're going to do is we're going to jump down to the bottom of our list. And we're going to talk about two pieces of moral evidence. Moral evidence, okay? Here we go. The first is that we live in a universe in which there appear to be transcendent, objective, moral truths. Transcendent, objective, moral truths. In other words, truths about morals, about morality, that are not just a matter of subjective opinion, but are actually true for all of us, regardless of our opinions. And that's a hard sell for some people. But I want to demonstrate, when I first started thinking about it, I was working in gangs. And I had been working for about 2 years in South Central Los Angeles. And I realized that in gangs, in cliques of gangs in the inner city, people have their own moral codes. There is a law amongst thieves. And you realize that when you start talking to gangsters. And you'll see that, okay, I had a case once in which one of our gangsters had a sister who was hit on by another rival gang member, who I either didn't know that she was a sister of a rival, or maybe he did know that she was a sister of a rival. I don't know, but he made a pass at her, and she didn't take it right, and so she went home and told her family about it and told her brother, and her brother then went out, captured this guy, and tortured him to death. Why? Because he did something that was against the code. It's like, duh. If you do this, you should expect to be treated this way. This is how, by the way, if I did that to your sister, I would expect you to do this to me too. It's part of the law of the gang, of the streets. This is how we run. And as you talk to these people, if it's just the gangster himself or to his friends, they would all affirm that, yeah, this is how this works. So I started to think, well, okay, so are all moral codes just a matter of how we think individually or how we think in groups? Because if they are, that means that moral laws would come from subjects, either one subject, me, or a bunch of us who decide together. That would still be a group of subjects who decide what is true morally. Or are there some moral truths that transcend us? We don't get to decide if these are morally vile or morally righteous things. They are decided before we ever show up. I started to think about this. So let me just give it to you in terms of a hierarchy, kind of a moral, legal hierarchy. So this guy's name was Jesse, who tortured this rival gang member. Now, he had a set of personal beliefs. Is that where all morals come from? No, actually, I don't think even he would agree with that, because he would say, well, no, I have to bend my knee to my clique. This gang has a set of beliefs. And if I want to be a part, I've got to know they get to this. But even that group there, they just can't park their car anywhere they want in the city. There are some places where it's against the law to park your car. And they don't get to decide that. The city decides that. So it turns out that the city's beliefs really kind of overrun the beliefs of the group and the beliefs of the individual. Make sense? And every city's got different laws about where you can park your car. And there are some, in California, laws in which if your car doesn't meet certain standards, you can't even put it on the street at all. Even if you think, well, in L.A., we don't care if our cars run like that. We don't care if our cars have got tags on them. We don't care. Well, so what? If you're in California, the California law trumps your city municipal code. The penal code trumps your municipal code. And even if in California certain conditions for cars need to be met, catalytic converters, for example, I bet you don't. Do you even have catalytic converters here in Ohio? Do you? Okay. In Texas, they didn't. So you could buy a car in Texas, but to get it back to California, you got to upgrade it. It costs about $1,500 because the laws are different in Texas for cars than they are. And it turns out there are some federal regulations governing vehicles that trump the state regulations. And there are lots of federal laws that trump for example, if you could legalize certain drugs in each state, if they're still illegal at the federal level, they could actually enforce the federal law. They won't probably, but they could, because the federal law would trump. Make sense? Now I say Trump, I don't mean President Trump. And then of course, you know, we're in a collection in a global community. And although I don't think it works this way, nor do I think it probably should, but the point is, the United Nations would say, well, I think that we should have something to say about how nations behave. Do you see what we have here? The question is, how high does this hierarchy go? Because if all morals are decided down here, well, then I think we got a problem, right? Because if he says it's okay to torture somebody who lives on the other side of town for saying something he shouldn't say to my sister, I have to listen to that. Okay, if all moral laws come from individuals, and he says it's okay to do that, and even his group says it's okay to do that, well, do I have to say it's okay then? No, right? Let's put it on, supersize it a little bit. Is it ever okay to torture babies for the fun of it? To torture people for the fun of it? No, I don't think it's ever okay to torture people. For what purpose? For fun. That's it. Now you might say, well, look, I'm going to do this because I'm going to save 2 billion lives because this guy's got the secret to the location of that atomic weapon. Well, okay, then maybe you... That's not what I'm saying here. I'm saying that you think it's okay to torture people for what reason? For fun. No, we would say it's not okay to do that. It's never okay to do that. I don't care what people group you're part of. This is a law that is not grounded here in this little individual because he actually thought it was okay to do that. And it's not grounded in the law of his group because they thought it was okay to do that. And it turns out it's not like, well, in our city, it's okay to torture people for fun. But in San Bernardino, it's not okay to torture people. No, it doesn't happen there. And it's not okay in California, but not okay in Ohio. No, this is a law that if you go up the ladder, you will see that it's not okay at any level. As a matter of fact, I think you go all the way to here. You know, if there's a Star Trek universe with Klingons and Romulans, it's not okay to torture Klingons for the fun of it. So that law actually doesn't just create it by groups, right? Because if it was okay for one group to capture, subjugate, and then murder 5 million Jews, and they could say, well, look, in our land, this is okay. Our group has decided that this is okay. We said, what? Okay, have at it. No, we tried those war criminals after the war in Nuremberg. And they said, what? They said, hey, it's okay. You can't try us now. I was promoted for this behavior. Yeah, I was a captain working at Auschwitz. But I was promoted for this. In our culture, we were told to do this. And we said, okay. And we got promoted for doing it. Now, because you win the war, you want to come in here and execute me? I don't think so. And we said, well, I guess you're right. Because, you know, if your culture says it's okay. No, we didn't say that. We had 3 judges from 3 different nations. And Robert Jackson, the American judge, said, no, there's a law above the law. Really? Is there a law above the law? Is there a law above the law of nations? Above the laws of states? Above individuals? That's the question. I think we know there is. Now, what's interesting about this is that there are people groups here. And that moral laws, like I said last night, are not just claims about morality. They are obligations between people groups, between persons. So, like I said last night, I am not morally obligated to my police car, nor am I morally obligated to my flashlight. These are not persons. Moral obligations are between... I'm also not morally obligated to physics, because physics is not personal. I am morally obligated to the members of my community, because these are the persons in my community. So my question is, if we don't think that moral laws are built down here, and we don't, and we don't think they're parts of nations, because if that was the case, we could never tell Germany they were wrong. If we think that moral laws transcend all of us, then my question is what I had last night. Who is the transcendent, objective, moral person that we feel obligated to? Because if all that's governing the universe is physics, you have no reason to feel guilty about anything. Your group could be wrong. Now, if there's a moral code that transcends your group, then you have a reason to feel guilty, because you've broken God's law. You've broken the law of this personal being that transcends everything. Make sense? Dawkins, of course, Richard Dawkins, who's an atheist, does not believe that there is any source of objective meaning or transcendent objective moral law. So when he thinks about this, he says that the universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. That's right. Physics doesn't care what you do. It doesn't. So under this worldview, if there is no objective, transcendent, moral person to whom you are obligated, this is an accurate description of the universe. And he gets it. He is at least being consistent with his atheistic worldview. Are we clear? So the question is, how can I get moral truths by staying inside the room of the universe? Well, I've got to stay inside the room with the critters that are in the room. It's either going to be from individuals or from people groups. And this is what I hear all the time. Moral codes come from individuals. Most people have moved away from that. Or they come from people groups. Societies decide what is morally true. There's a third option that'll keep you in the room. If all moral truths are simply an illusion, they don't really exist. And that's what really Dawkins is saying. There are no moral truths. That's an illusion because the physics doesn't care what you do. Well, now I can explain our moral codes by staying in the room. Either they're created by an individual in the room, groups in the room, or they don't exist at all. Well, I can stay inside the room for an answer. All three of these answers will get you in the room. Make sense? The problem, of course, is if individuals get to decide what is true, then you cannot complain with the person sitting next to you who wants to eat you for dinner. You can't. You might not like it, but you can't say it's wrong, because if your view of wrong is equal to their view of wrong and you two disagree, there's nobody to adjudicate between you. If you say, well, no, in our group right here, this aisle to this aisle, we do not believe you should eat the person sitting next to you. But this group thinks it's okay. Is there anyone to adjudicate between the two groups? So the problem exists also for groups, is that if groups get to decide, then you cannot call what anyone is. If you're saying one of the largest group then gets to decide what's right, because how do you decide if Germany was right or if England was right? How do you decide if Germany is right or if, well, America's, we won the war. We outnumbered them. We were stronger than them. Really? So numbers, might makes right? Is that what you're saying? If that's the case, be ready to accept whatever moral teaching comes out of China, because they outnumber you dramatically. And if they end up being a powerful military force, you'd have to at least say this: I don't know if I like it or not, but clearly it's morally right, because moral rightness is decided by the biggest group. No, we don't believe that. These two systems will not get you. And of course, to say that there are no moral truths, really? You don't think there's a moral truth about torturing babies for fun? You don't think there's a moral truth about pedophilia? You don't think that these things, you're comfortable calling these things illusions? I'm not. There's another way to get moral truth. What if, in fact, there's just a standard, an objective, transcendent, moral person? Not who creates moral law. That's not what we're saying God does. We don't believe that God creates a law of right or wrong. And we don't believe that law of right or wrong exists before God. The law of right or wrong is simply a reflection of his holy character. No God, no reflection. With God, you have a universe that is governed by his holy character. Follow me? So it's not that God creates. God can't do everything, by the way. You know that, right? God is all powerful, but he can't do everything. God cannot sin. Can't. Why? It's not part of his holy nature. Now, is that a limitation of God's power? No, that's a strength of God's power. He can't sin. It's because he is all powerful and he's all righteous that he would never sin. God cannot lie. God cannot create a square circle. Because he's not a moral liar and he's not logically inconsistent. He cannot create a married bachelor. This is not a limitation of God's character. It is because God is the source of all logical truths and the source of all moral truths that he is always going to be logically consistent and morally consistent. This is not a limitation of God's power. I put it this way. God cannot do stupid things, okay? Because can I create a rock that's too heavy to lift? No, God cannot do stupid things, okay? Because that's stupid. That's logically inconsistent. So you can create some weird logical, can he create a square circle? No, that's a stupid thing. I don't believe in a stupid God. Now, this explanation, though, that God is the source of objective, that means we've got to jump outside the room to get to the best explanation of what we are experiencing inside the room. Follow me? Jerry Fodor puts it this way. Science is about facts, not norms. It might tell us how we are, but it couldn't tell us what is wrong with how we are. There couldn't be a science of the human condition. I think he's right. Now, of course, if there is a personal, transcendent, objective source of moral truth and obligation, that would explain why we sense that, why we actually feel that inside the room. Let me jump to the end here. Because this last one, I think, is the deal killer for a lot of people. If I have 8 good reasons to believe you're the suspect, but then I discovered on the day of the crime that you're in Italy and you weren't here in Ohio, dang, you sure looked good for me until I discovered you couldn't have done it. Well, you might have all this good evidence that points to God's existence, but is this the thing that demonstrates he couldn't have done it? How do you explain evil then? If God exists and is the creator of all things and he's all powerful and all loving, how could he allow evil? I get asked this question a lot. This is a picture of my dad. He's walking over this guy here who committed a crime in our city in 1972. He was accused. He confessed to it. Death of a 10-year-old girl. Terrible death. The way she died was no one should die this way. My dad hates this picture. Well, look at him. Look at that mustache. Seriously, what is that? I'm not sure what that is, really. It's like perfectly angled there. I don't get it. Is that weird? By the way, nobody anymore wears just a mustache with no other facial hair. Have you noticed that? Nobody does that anymore. If you're wearing any kind of facial hair today, you are wearing a beard or a goatee or no facial hair. Am I right? If you in this room right now have just got a mustache and that's it, just a mustache, raise your hand. Raise your hand. Look in the back over there. Look in the back over there. I just proved my point. Old guy right there. Right? Who else? Are you a young man with a mustache? Okay, sit down. Person sitting next to him right now. Slap him in the side of the head. There you go. Thank you. Seriously? You need to shave that off back there. Shave it off. Not going to do it, are you? This gives you away right away. This gives you away. This is the last time that mustaches alone were popular was 1974. Okay, I'm just telling you that right now. Also, he hates it because he looks like his butt sticking out right here. Look at that. Like, what kind of body is that? I mean, just look at it for a second. Seriously. Looks normal, looks normal, looks normal, looks normal, looks... What's that? Oh my gosh, look at the width from here to there. Okay, normal, normal width. What is this? Weevils wobble, but they don't fall down. Right? That's actually his gun. You can't tell that's his gun under his... So he's got an excuse there. Now, to get serious for a second, it ends up that this girl was killed on a holiday. And her family asked me for years afterwards, why, if there is a loving God who is powerful enough to stop the murder of my daughter, who was 10, why didn't he stop it? I think it's a really good question. It's hard to answer that question. But I know that the answer is not simple. Just like solving the case won't be simple, because a certain number of factors have to be in place in order to explain the death of this girl. Number one, she was the kind of girl, and we'll call her Jackie for the purposes of this talk. Jackie was the kind of girl who would get into someone's car. She was friendly. We always tell your kids, do not get into the car with a stranger. Duh. You know why? Because this stuff was happening in the early 70s. We tell you that for a reason. She didn't have that instruction, and she would get in the car of a stranger. If she's not the kind of girl who gets into a stranger's car, this doesn't happen. That's the first domino that has to be in place. Two, it happened on a busy holiday during the day when their mom was making dinner and was not watching her and told her, in fact, go play in the front yard. Don't come back in here until a certain time because I'm busy making dinner. So she was not being watched. If it hadn't happened on a day that she's not watched and she isn't the kind of girl who gets into a car, this does not occur. Three, it turns out the kind of person who would do this to a young girl probably has a disturbing upbringing of his own. I've never worked a pedophile who did not have his own disturbing background. But if he hadn't had that disturbing upbringing and she isn't the kind of person who would get into a car and it's not a holiday, this crime doesn't occur. Also, he happened to know how to get into this weird part of our town that was kind of isolated. You wouldn't know how to even, if you don't know this town well, you're not going to even be able to find this neighborhood, okay? It wasn't easy to get in and get out of, but apparently he knew how to get in and get out of it. If he doesn't know how to do that, she doesn't get in his car and it's not a holiday and he's not a guy with a bad background, this doesn't happen. All of these things have to be in place. He has to actually even have a vehicle that he could use to commit this crime and a location and the timing possible to get away with it. We didn't find her body till the next morning. One county north of us on the coast, dumped on the beach. All of these things have to be connected in order. How do I solve cases? I have to take these factors into consideration and try to unpuzzle it. And I know that all of these things somehow are connected. I may not understand the connections right away, but all of these things and the way they are connected will eventually explain why this act of evil occurred. Does that make sense? Now, we've already looked at 7 pieces of evidence, 2 from cosmology. There's 2 that are biology, 2 that are mental, 1 that is moral. All of these things, I think, point most reasonably to the existence of a God outside the realm of the universe. And when you have good evidence that points to a suspect, that is called inculpating evidence. Are we clear? Inculpating evidence points to your suspect. Now we have this 8th thing, evil. My question is this the thing that is kind of like the alibi, the thing that says, okay, he was in France at the time of the murder. He wasn't there. Is this exculpating evidence? Inculpating points toward your suspect, exculpating points toward another cause. And that's what I want to talk about in this last talk I'm going to do with you. Here's how the claim has been made famously in antiquity. Epicurus puts it this way. Is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Then he's not omnipotent. Is he able but not willing? Well, then he's malevolent. Is he both able and willing? Then whence cometh evil? Is he neither able nor willing? Then why call him God? In other words, if God is all-powerful, then why doesn't he stop it? Because he can't? Well, then don't stop calling him all-powerful. He doesn't want to stop it? Then stop calling him all-loving. If he's all-powerful and all-loving, he should be able to and want to stop it. If neither is happening, maybe there is no God. I think there are actually a number of reasons why a good, all-powerful, all-loving God might allow bad things to happen to his creation. But it's a cumulative case the same way we built the case with Jackie. I think you've got to consider the view, an accurate view of eternity. You've got to understand what free agency plays in this. How do we define love? How do we look at our character development in times like this? Does it have power to draw us to God? Also, what is the consequence of our stupidity to begin with? And finally, what limits do we have in our own understanding? All of these things have to be considered simultaneously to explain evil. Now, it might sound like a lot of things to talk about, but they go really fast. Are you ready? Here's why this happened to Jackie, and here's why you've had evil happen in your own life. Before I start, though, let me just say this to you. For some people who've already suffered evil, it doesn't feel great to have some knucklehead come on the stage and give you 8 academic reasons why evil occurs. That doesn't feel satisfying, because what you need is not an explanation academically. You need someone to come alongside you and walk with you through pain. I get that. So if evil is in your rearview mirror, this may not be a very satisfying talk. On the other hand, if evil is still ahead of you through the windshield and you haven't experienced it yet, understanding what is happening here before you experience evil will be of great value. Because it's helped me to process, well, why would you? I've had lots of things that I've seen or had to deal with has never dissuaded me in the existence of God. Why? Because these things are in place in my mind. Does that make sense? So I want to help you at least process with these 7 things. Here's the first one. I think eternity makes all the difference in the world. All the difference. The biggest thing, the biggest factor, I think, is a proper view of eternity. Here's what I mean by that. As an atheist, I expected to live, and my hope was to live 90 pain-free, delightful years. Right? From the cradle to the coffin, I wanted to live 90 pain-free years. Why? I've got longevity in my family. My family lives into their 90s, and they don't suffer from Alzheimer's or anything, and they don't die of heart attacks. They just live to be old. And then, you know, they die peacefully in their sleep. It's awesome. That's what I want. I want 90 pain-free years as an atheist, because this is how I viewed life. I viewed life as a line segment, point to point. Now, if I had gotten sick with cancer at the age of 40 and then suffered 10 years and dropped dead, I'd have been ticked off. Why? Well, because evil is measured in the context of your life expectations. I expected to get 90 pain-free. Now you're telling me I only got 40 pain-free? Then I suffered for 10 and died? That's evil. Got it? But why do I think it's evil? Because I lost something I expected. Well, what if my view of life, though, is incorrect? What if life is not a line segment from point to point, but is instead a ray, begins at birth, travels through this thing we call death, but then it goes off into this direction forever? That's what rays do. They start at one point, go through another, and they extend in that direction forever. Would that change things? How many of you in this room, when you were born, you suffered some birth defect that required you to have some operation that saved your life? Okay, great. Now, if I'd have stopped your life 1 month in, you'd have said, man, life stinks. Okay, it's terrible. It's full of pain. It's terrible. But by the time you're like 3, you're already over it. You don't even remember what surgery you went through in 1, okay? Because pain, suffering, is measured in the context of your lifespan. And because by 3, you've already forgotten what you suffered in the first month, by the time you're here, you're like, yeah, I suffered evil, but hey, I'm already over it. I got a long life to live. Now think about it. If your worldview is Christianity, I can see why as an atheist you'd be upset about evil. But not as a Christian. We think that your life is a ray. That means that the more you all go into eternity, every year you spend in eternity, your temporal earthly life seems shorter and shorter and shorter by comparison to your life in eternity. It turns out that you as a Christian, this is an accurate depiction of your life. A millisecond spent on earth, eternity, 100 years into eternity. Okay, I get it. 1,000 years into eternity. Wow, that seemed like nothing. It's like that month you suffered your surgery by the time you're three. That's what it feels like. Evil has now been put in its proper place relative to your life, your eternal life. Do you get it? Part of the problem is that we say we believe Christianity is true, and we live as though we're atheists. We live as though whatever happens to us in the 90 years we get here determines the goodness of God. When in fact, our lives are defined this way, as rays that go off forever. You could have 90 terrible years. They would be a millisecond compared to eternity. Do you see the difference? Eternity changes everything. But also we have to ask ourselves, well, do you think that our free agency plays any role in this? I think it does. Look, and these two possibilities, a world in which God makes love possible or a world in which God says no love is possible, which world do you think a loving God would want to create? I think he wants to create this world. I think a loving God wants to create a world in which you and I can love. Like, duh, that's what a loving God does, right? Well, are you really? Do you want that kind of world? My wife and I, we were married on Valentine's Day. Imagine that we break up. 5 years goes by, and I decide I want to try to win her back. So when Valentine's Day comes around, I send her a card in an effort to win her back. I want her to love me again. So I send her this Valentine's Day card. You will love me. Roses are red. Bullets are lead. Take me back now or get shot in the head. Now, do you think she is going to love? She'll love me now, right? Now, the reason why we think that's stupid is because we know that love cannot be compelled. I can tell my kids, you will love me. And they can say, okay, yeah, we love you. Do they really love me? You will tell me you love me or you will not get dinner tonight. Okay, we love you. Do they really love me? No, it turns out if you want true love, it has to be utterly uncompelled. It has to be a complete free choice on the part of the person offering the love. Make sense? But that means you need a condition in place before you could ever have love. If you think there's a loving God who creates a world in which love is possible, that means he has to create a world with free agency. Are you sure you want that? Because that means you have to get love. You can't get love unless people have the freedom to hate. You want love? I've got to open the floodgates to all kinds of things if I'm going to make love, true love, possible. Because if you can't, if the only thing you're capable of doing is loving God, you aren't really loving God. It's when you decide to freely love God instead of rejecting him hatefully that you do truly love God. But that means I've got to allow a world in which people can freely hate. This is a dangerous place, but you cannot have one without the other. A world in which love is possible is a dangerous place to live. But love is possible here. Now, it's not as though God throws this knife at you called free agency and doesn't tell you how to catch it by the handle or the blade. That's not what he does. God gives you this scary thing called free agency, and then he gives you a guidebook so you will not misuse your free agency. Some of us will ignore the guidebook. That's not on God. That's on those of us who ignore the rules. Because God's given us two things, this crazy free agency and explicit instructions how to use it carefully so you won't get cut. It's just those of us who ignore the rule book that get cut. There's a third thing, though. What do we even mean when we say that God is loving? How could an all-loving God allow anything bad to... I lost my job last week. How could an all-loving God allow me to lose my job? I can't even make the bills. I can't even feed my family. What do you mean by love when you say God is all loving? Do you mean the words that we see in TV, on Netflix, or in books? Typically, the culture thinks that this is what love is, right? It's this kindness and gentleness and adoration and lust and affection we have for things. There's another definition, an important part of the definition of love that's missing from here, though, right? And all of you parents in the room, you know what's missing. What's missing is the last definition, this idea of tough love. But it turns out tough love is incredibly important. I have a daughter who's 23 now. And when she first went away to school, she moved 8 hours from us and she promptly dropped out of school. And I told her, if you do that, I get it. She's not really a school person. I get it, okay. But if you're going to do that, you're going to have to be untethered, right? Because I'll help you as long as you're going to school. But if you're going to make this decision, you're going to have to be untethered. And she has successfully supported herself now for 3 years. I'm pretty impressed. But at first, it was hard because there were times when her car would break down and she's like, oh, my car just broke down. And I'm tempted to fix it for her. But I didn't. If she's going to be untethered and unequipped, maybe this will be the thing that drives her back to equipping herself. Right? So I can't fix all the problems. But as a loving father, I decided to not respond to that request. And she wasn't really requesting it. She was kind of requesting it by telling me it happened, right? I think this happens all the time with God. We want God to kind of answer all of our requests. When in fact, I can still love, because I love my daughter, that I'm not answering that request. C.S. Lewis, and you know who he is, I think he said it best when he said this. He says, we want, in fact, not so much a father in heaven as a grandfather in heaven. You know, a senile benevolence who, as they say, liked to see young people enjoying themselves, and whose plan for the universe was simply that it might be said at the end of each day, a good time was had by all. That's not God. Now look, let's go back to our timeline for a second. You have your temporal life, and you have this eternity you spend with God. Okay, this is our temporal life. This is our eternal life. Now, there's another way of expressing these. This is, in essence, our earthly life, and this is our post-earthly life. Now, while we're here on earth, we have parents. Parents that might allow some evil to occur, like your operation, because they know something good is to be achieved by allowing this evil. Yeah, but Jim, I don't get it. Well, look, you've got a post-earthly father, right? He might also allow some evil to occur in your life. Yeah, but I've seen people who have the evil and nothing ever good ever came of it. Really? Knucklehead, think about it. You're waiting for the good thing to happen over here. How do you know where God, what God's trying to achieve? Maybe he wants this to happen over here. He's in charge of all of this. He might allow you to suffer something here because he's got something good in mind over here. He is the God and the Father of your eternal life. Parents do this. Parents and God, I think we care less about your comfort than we do about your character. And I think God is after, like any good parent, he's after something lasting, not something immediate. The same way I'm after something lasting in my daughter's life, not just to solve this problem today. When we talk about this also, I used to think this is the worst explanation ever offered for evil, this idea that somehow God is going to develop my character through evil. Really? You couldn't do it some other way? This is a lame explanation if you ask me. But if you think about it, it's not so lame. Because as an atheist, I would have told you, if I could design my ideal world, it would have some virtuous character in it. In other words, as an atheist, I wanted to live in a world that had these attributes. I think most atheists would agree. These are good things we'd like to see in our world, right? Courage and compassion and forgiveness and self-sacrifice and charity. Really? You want those things in your world? If God was trying to design a world in which these characters, I think a good God who loves us would want us to live in this kind of world, don't you? But if you want that kind of world, you're going to have to endure something. Because these are not just magical characteristics he snaps his fingers and you get. You only get courage in the face of what? Danger. You only get compassion in the face of suffering. You only get forgiveness or develop a desire to forgive in the face of evil. You only develop self-sacrifice in the face of hardship. You only become charitable in the face of poverty. If you want those other good things, you would have to design a world that looks like this. Oh, that's what we have. This is why I never, ever, ever, ever pray for patience. Why would you do that? If you pray for patience, how do you think that God gives that to you? He just goes, you now have patience. No. He develops that in you by testing you and testing you and testing you and testing you. If you want patience, you don't pray for that. Right? Because he's about to punch you with something. And you're going to have to be patient through that. And now at the end of it, you'll be able to say, well, I developed some patience in that. Yeah, but that was not fun. Right? So if you want all of these great things in your world, this is how Lewis puts it. To ask that God's love should be content with us as we are is to ask that God should cease to be God. Because he is what he is, his love must, in the nature of things, be impeded and repelled by certain stains in our present character. And because he already loves us, he must labor to make us lovable. And sometimes that doesn't feel good to us. But it turns out that often he can use these bad things to draw us to him because we run out of our own resources. When I was a non-believer, I used to say, really? So you want God? God could reach people a number of ways. Why doesn't he just reach each person and just, you know, make it clear that he exists, and then he can just reach out gently and draw each person to himself? Really? Well, when I was an atheist, this was happening for me. I mean, he sent me a letter I refused to open. I was stuck in a surveillance team where I spent, you know, 10 hours a day in a car following guys doing robberies. That's what we were doing. And in that car, it seemed like I had to really work hard to avoid all the Christian radio programming that was going on in the car. I hated it, right? I tried to avoid it, but I could have listened to it. No, I refused to do that. He put people in my life that shared the truth with me, and I refused to listen to them. Well, guess what? He is reaching out to us in this way every single day. But if we aren't going to pay attention to that, he could get us another way. He could, instead of reaching out, he could push us to him. That's the other way he could get us. And how is he going to do that? Through hardship. When we are done thinking we can do it for ourselves, then God could do it a different way. Lewis puts it this way, let me implore the reader to try to believe, if only for the moment, that God, who made these deserving people, may really be right when he thinks that their modest prosperity and happiness of their children are not enough to make them blessed. That all this must fall from them in the end. Yep, that's true. Sometimes we're distracted by all of this stuff. And the people who are prosperous right now and seem happiest right now, and they are probably the furthest from God. Because why do you need God? Why would I need God if everything's working? Sometimes you just need to take those things away so the last leg you can stand on is the only leg that matters. Now, sometimes we just deserve what we get because God is just. And we talk about this all the time, right? How can a loving God be a loving God if he's not a just God? I think in order to be a loving father, I have to be a just father. What I mean is, if I was to say, if I drove down the street with my son David, and we're driving down the street, and I look over at him in the car, and I say, David, I just want you to know, I respect you so much for what you've been able, who you are as a person. I just love you more than I can say. He might think, well, wow, he's a pretty loving father. But then, as we go two blocks further, I see a guy in a shootout run out of a liquor store doing a robbery, and I stop him. I say, sir, I just want you to know I so love and respect who you are, and I love you more than I can say. I say the exact same words to that guy that I just said to my son David. Well, now my son David's going to know those words don't really mean anything because he unjustly gives them to anybody. It turns out what makes my love tangible is the just way in which I distribute it. That I honor righteousness and you see what I'm saying? Justice is the backside of mercy. You cannot have mercy without justice. A judge that is merciful to everyone is being unjust to victims. But a judge who is like, you've got to pay for this, is just a tyrant. You have to have this combination, this delicate combination of justice and mercy connected. I think God does have that. I think God is a loving God, but he is a just God, and there are three forms of justice. And we have to understand this is how God works in these three forms of justice. The first one is pretty easy to see, and we talk about it all the time, it's retributive justice. And this is this idea that you're like your kids, they do something. I've caught myself doing this. I try not to do it, but I do it sometimes. This idea that I want to sometimes punish my kids for things they've done in the past. I am so mad that you did that yesterday. This is your punishment. This kind of justice is really focused on past events. What I try as a parent to do also, though, is to look at what is called utilitarian justice. And this is not backwards thinking. This is forward thinking. Look, I know what you did yesterday. I shouldn't have done it, but that's not what I'm worried about. My concern is this. If you continue this behavior, you are going to be a train wreck in 5 years. I need to punish you now, not for the past. I need to punish you for the sake of the future. That is utilitarian justice. Make sense? The third kind of justice is called restorative justice. And this is the idea that you are just simply to repay an injustice. And there are times when we are commanded, and even in our law today, if you're convicted of a murder, you might be punished for the past to protect people in the future, but also you're going to be asked to repay some compensation to the victim's family. All three of these are administered by loving parents. I think as parents, we have mastered trying to balance these three forms of justice. And this is also true for God. Is if you want him to love you, be prepared for some discipline. We see that in Hebrews, right? He talks about what son does God love that he doesn't discipline? The fact that you're being disciplined does not mean he doesn't love you. It's actually a sign that he does. Last thing. Sometimes it's about a limited understanding. We think we can really solve this problem with our finite minds. Look at the complaint that was offered by Epicurus. He says, is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Well, then he's omnipotent. Is he able but not willing? Well, then he's malevolent. Do you see what Epicurus has done? He's tried to catch the believer in a conundrum. You've got an all-powerful and all-loving God. How could he allow this? The first part of the complaint really is describing the omnipotence of God, the all-powerful nature of God. The second part of the complaint is describing the all-loving part of God. But here's why he carefully, you realize as Christians, this is not our definition of God. This is not our definition of God. It's part of our definition of God. And Epicurus cleverly leaves out the third piece because the third piece he left out explains the first two. This is not a conundrum if you put in the third piece. We believe in a God that is all-powerful, all-loving, and all-knowing. Look, go to our timeline. This is the stuff that we know about. But clearly, God knows about all this stuff. So you think you understand why stuff's happening to you? You can't see this stuff. You can't even see this stuff if you're over here. You think you can tell what's going to happen in 10 years? Do you think I knew I'd be doing this work 5 years ago? I was still in trial on two cases. I hadn't even written a book. I wasn't working in Christian ministry. I was a detective in Los Angeles. You can't even tell what's going to happen 5 years from now. You have no idea what God's got planned for you. But if there is a God, he would know. I think that a famous French Dominican priest said it best. Let's just let him say it. If God would concede me his omnipotence for 24 hours, you would see how many changes I would make in the world. Yeah, but if he gave me his wisdom too, I would leave things as they are. Because you don't know what you would change that might cause some other problem later. We are all interconnected, and our futures are all interconnected, and only God knows what dominoes get pushed over to create future domino falls. You don't know what those are. You've watched enough science fiction to know the butterfly effect, right? There really is a butterfly effect, and God is the one who knows the answer. So I look at these seven things, and I think, okay, this is how evil occurs. The only problem is I don't know the proportions. So for any act of evil, including Jackie, I don't know which of these God has prioritized in this particular act that he has allowed to happen. He is not the source of evil. He has simply allowed this to happen. Why? Because I don't know what he's trying. It could be this is the cause. This might be the first priority. I don't know what God's priorities are. I also don't know how these things are connected. But I do trust that God, there's an explanation for this. Because there are seven good reasons to believe God might allow this to happen. But let me just ask you this. Why are you calling this evil to begin with? Why do you think that what happened to Jackie is evil? Her killer did not think it was evil. He did it again. He had no problem doing it. Why do you think it's evil? You clearly think it's evil. But why do you think it's evil? Lewis realized that this was the turning point in his own thinking about God. He said it this way, "My argument against God was that the universe seems so cruel and unjust. But how had I gotten this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? In other words, if you think this is evil, well, why? Because you don't like it? You personally don't like it? No, no. You think it's evil for everyone? So what standard are you using? What objective, transcendent moral standard do you think exists that allows you to call this thing that happened to Jackie transcendently evil? Well, it turns out you would need a standard in place before you could call this truly evil. You would need a standard of true goodness in place. It turns out that evil cannot exist without the standard. There is no shadow without the sunshine. So if you want to stay in the room, people might say, well, wait a minute, you say that God is the best explanation? No, there's evil in the room. If there's evil in the room, that disqualifies God. Really? Well, wait a minute. If you don't have a standard of good, then there cannot be evil. So if there is evil, there must be some standard of good outside the room that you are using to measure the activity in the room and call it evil. Evil ends up being just another proof, just another piece of evidence that points to the existence of God. It's another piece of inculpating evidence. It's not exculpating. Lewis said this when he finally figured it out. He said, of course, I could have given up my idea of justice by saying it was nothing but a private idea of my own. It's an opinion. Evil. But if I did that, then my argument against God collapsed too, for the argument depended on saying that the world was really unjust, not simply that it did not happen to please my private fancies. That's right. If you think the world is truly unjust, then you have to have more than your subjective or collective opinion to base that on. Of course, if there is a standard outside the room that transcends you, that would explain why we call things evil. But that means we've got to go outside the room for an answer.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.